Welcome to the T&D podcast brought to you by TomTom. We think you're trucking awesome. You deserve a trucking awesome app. That's why today we're excited to talk about the ultimate trucking companion, TomTom Go Navigation. With premium features designed to make every delivery a breeze, Go Navigation ensures you reach your destination efficiently and stress-free.
Hello and welcome to the Truck and Driver podcast. It's Matt Ireland here once again, and I'm going to speak with Paul O'Callaghan today. For a bit of a change, give Dougie a break. Morning, Paul. How are you doing?
Good morning, Matt, or afternoon where I am here. It's just past 12 in high noon, and I'm coming to you from the bunk of a Kenworth.
It looks a bit sunny for a change.
Yeah, look, it's pretty much always sunny out here in Australia. So at the moment, I'm in a place called Northampton.
Northampton?
Yeah.
So not quite on the A45?
No. It's on the west coast of Australia. So I'd be here probably roughly, I'm just thinking, maybe about 400, 500 kilometres north of Perth on the west coast.
Yeah.
Temperature here is about 18 degrees.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah, it gets down to about 9 or maybe 10 degrees it was last night where I was further south down, kind of close enough to Perth, so the Aussies reckon it's freezing when it gets down to about 9 degrees. And then of course, you know, we're kind of based up north, and up there it's more, they don't get any sort of winter or weather up there, or you know, around this time of year in the dry season you get, you know, cold maybe at night time, but you'll always get that nice kind of a still cold at night, and then it gets up to, you know, 30 degrees during the day, and you don't have that real humidity. Although I just heard on the there's a bit of a cold front coming in, and I think I heard on the weather report there it's going to be -1 or -2 in the red centre in around Alice Springs. But it's just quite nice, comfortable weather at the moment, Matt. The big problem kind of up this, well, for us, issue for us is just the strong winds we get up this west coast, and you know what we're pulling here when you've got three cattle trailers, which are probably the most unaerodynamic trailers you could have on the road, because you can imagine the wind going into all the, you know, the air vents, and it's just swirling around in there, so you get a strong wind, and really pulls you back. So I'm empty now, and I'm heading northbound, so I've got a bit of time to pull in here and have a yarn to you.
Excellent. So you can just take your time, especially with the wind, and keep it all under control. And of course, it's Australia's winter time now, isn't it? So the depths of winter, I guess, whilst we're, we'd like to say scorching, but on the East Coast here, it rained yesterday. So British summer might officially be on paper, but it's not quite got here in weather. But you know, that's what us Brits like to moan about, is the weather. So
well, look, it's the first thing. It's the first thing. It's just a natural sort of a default that was the first thing I said. But of course, Australia is such a vast continent. You know, they'll get their winters down south here, and up north we just get with the dry season and the wet season, and it's always. Busy. It's always nice and sunny and hot. It just depends on how hot or how humid it is. But it's countryside. They've got quite a lot of rain down here lately, so crops would have been put in the ground back around April, and they'll be starting to harvest around October. So I'm just at the kind of northern tip of the wheat belt, which is a huge area, you know, which radiates kind of east from, you know, Perth, and it's a big industry down here. So everything, the crops are just kind of getting a really, really nice green look down here. You know, once you get into your summertime down here, the place, it gets very kind of barren and dry looking. But at the moment, it looks beautiful. And they got some quite heavy, they got some well-needed rain, and like just further north now, where it'll be going up around Geraldton and places like that. So it's kind of like a land of extremes out there. You know, it's always, you'll look on the, people will probably look in the news and you'll see floods over east and places over here that don't get any rain, and then there's, I actually drove down past Geraldton the other night, and there was water across the road, which was quite nice to see. But I'll have a pretty it'll be a just a fairly relaxing drive. So we, you know, with this livestock job, it's, you're, you know, there's a lot of empty running, really. There's no even with, you know, a lot of these freight jobs up north, like everything is kind of you know, the mines, that they'll have a lot of supplies and things going into the mines, and then those guys, you'll see them with one trailer on top of another, and they're kind of coming back empty. And it's a bit similar with us with the cattle. You know, we bring the cattle point A to point B, and generally that's it. You're just back empty. So it's kind of quite good in that regard. You can just...
Right, excellent.
Yeah.
I guess it's not a huge amount of call for a backload, especially for a cattle float heading back towards the area,
Yeah, well, there was a point when we were bringing back stock feed, you know, in big kind of 1-ton or maybe 650, 700 kilogram bags, you know. There was quite a lot of work involved in that, because we were able to, we've got a mesh on the floor, you know, to stop the cattle falling over, and we were able to fold it up to the sides. And of course, you have to wash out and reverse each trailer onto a bay. So it was quite a time consuming, laborious process, and we don't really do that anymore. So there's not really much. It's more of a thing, like a lot of the, all of the Irish cattle trucks which go to the continent, they'll all bring back, they'll have return loads. A lot of times it'll be ceramics from Spain or Italy. Onions is another thing they'll bring back, or just about basically any cargo, but they'll be a bit more set up for it, and there will be those backloads that'll pay for their shipping.
Right.
With us, it's the one kind of thing I like about this job, is that you can just open a few gates and your cargo is offloaded in like 20 minutes and away you go again.
That's that, yeah, perfect. Almost like being a bus driver, isn't it?
Yeah, well, exactly, yeah. You might get a little bit of back chat or a few disgruntled employees or passengers every now and then, but yeah, that's not a bad comparison.
Yeah, par for the course.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, when you say about backloads in cattle floats, I just remember seeing, I think it's in Calais once, it must have been coming up towards Christmas, because it was a full load of Christmas trees in a cattle float, and I just looked at it and thought, it was pretty ingenious. That must have been a bit of a job to load it as well, having to go through the back.
Yeah, it's if you go down to Italy, down around that Pistoia region, I'm sure you know that bit of road kind of from... You're heading across from, Florence kind of direction across for Pisa. Not sure what the name, but yeah. there's just a massive area for, especially around that Pistoia, just for growing plants. So that's quite a regular backload. And when you think about it, the cattle trailers are actually perfect for it, because plants need ventilation. They need a bit of air. So even a lot of times they'll bring them back in fridges, but they'll have to open those little kind of air hatches in them, and you'll often see guys back doors open. So that's another one. But it was interesting to see how they load it. So there'll be different sizes. There'll be some quite big trees, but of course, typical Italy, you know, they like their small little machines adapted for purposes. They have a little small articulated loader with an attachment on the front of the loader, which can grab the base of a potted plant or a potted tree, whatever the case may be, and it's able to tilt it forward so it fits, you know, under the roof of the trailer, and they can drive in. So they stack all the plants at about a 45 degree angle. That's how they get the most in.
Right.
Yeah. And it's, yeah. So that's, yeah, I've loaded there a couple of times. It's the only problem I had was, well, not problem, but just the thing that they put the really, really big trees on at the end, because it's just easy for them into the trailer. But then of course you end up with the weight over the back and pretty light up on the pins. So yeah, I had a few little nervous moments, you know, before you kind of get to know how to handle that load. But yeah, it's of course, a lot of those cattle trailers now, they'll have curtains which they can pull around, so basically they can carry just about everything and keep the cargo dry. And a big thing was as well, when they brought in the trailers, that didn't really, you could put two pallet spaces wide in them. So the ramps or the rams in the side of the trailer are kind of a lot more flush. They made it to that kind of a spec. So yeah, it's quite, you never know what's really been moved around unless you see inside.
Yeah, very true. Yeah, unless you can hear it.
Unless you can hear it, yeah. And then if you take, you know, the pigs, for example, like a lot of the pig trailers now, they don't even have open sides in them. It's all done through via air conditioning, you know. They'll have a generator on the trailer, or they can use the truck or the backup. So it's a lot of it's to do with disease minimization. Mm-hmm. They're not getting any airborne disease. So yeah, a lot of times with those, especially those, you know, Danish pig transporters, will be very advanced in that regard, and kind of keeps a lot of the maybe unwanted attention away from what you're doing as well.
Yeah, very true. Well, I was thinking about that the other day, really. Back when they used to be all the protests like down Brightland Sea for export and stuff like that, and it all just seems like quite a distant memory now. But I guess people are still having issues with protesters here and there as to what they're up to.
There is. Just out here, actually, what's kind of in the news at the moment is they're in the process of banning the live export of sheep out here. So there's been quite a lot of protest there, and it looks like it's been passed through the lower house, and it'll be banned in a couple of years. So it's going to have a very negative impact on the whole industry out here in Western Australia. So it's just unfortunate to see that some of these minority groups can have that much of a say, really, and people who live, city dwellers, who don't really understand, and they have the highest, they have an ECAS system here, they have the highest standards of animal welfare shipping anywhere in the world. So I mean, the meat consumption across the world has actually tripled in the last 50 years and increases all the time. So those markets where those sheep have been exported, they'll just get it somewhere else. More than likely won't have the same kind of standards.
Won't be as ethical.
Yeah. Won't be as ethical, yeah, exactly. So take the whole big picture into account. I'm sure a lot of these so-called, I don't even like the term animal rights, we're all for animal rights, but groups will be, feeling quite proud of their achievement, but really all you're doing is moving the industry.
Yeah, passing the buck.
Yeah, pass the buck, exactly, yeah. So look, it's just an unfortunate way of the world at the moment, Matt.
Yes. Yes, it is, mate. It is. But one thing that intrigues me is, how did you end up trucking down in Australia? Because a lot of people, sort of, when they leave school, they might go for a year on a work permit. Certainly a friend of mine did, and I actually went out and visited him. We travelled for a month in Oz. But you're out there, and no offence, but you're not a student anymore, are you, Paul? Let's be honest.
No,
you're quite a well experienced man. How did you end up getting out there?
So I was quite well past the student stage, Matt, as you say. Even when I came out here first, and that was 2012, so 12 years ago, and
wow, yeah.
Yeah, so I've been kind of out here pretty much, every year since. Missed a couple of years through COVID and that when I was back in Europe. But I came out here, the first time I ever came here before that was in my mid-20s, and we did one of those kind of backpacker holidays on the East Coast. But I always had a desire and an interest in kind of seeing the outback. And never really got to do it. I suppose I'd been on, driving, doing continental work from Ireland, and I had this discussion with a friend of mine lately. He was talking about places he hadn't seen, but he's been driving on the continent, all throughout his 20s, and he's in his 30s now, and he just loves it so much. You don't really have that urge to go and see somewhere else. But I suppose I'd kind of reached a point. I was in my early 30s, and I'd taken a few years away from driving. I was working in a sales job, and of course, as you're aware, like the driving buzz or bug never leaves you, and the wanderlust,
no,
sense of adventure and that. So maybe at a bit of a crossroads, and it was one moment in particular. I remember I was watching a DVD, it was called Legends of the Outbacks, and it had a Kenworth cattle road train coming charging through a cloud of bull dust, and I just remember looking at it going, I'm going out there. And I didn't even think I'd get a job at the time. I just wanted to go out there to see it and even go out for a holiday and record it and document it. And it sort of just kind of went from there, really. Contacts, Matt, would be it's all about kind of if you know someone.
Absolutely.
Like I came out completely on my own, and but I did know one man who worked for, like, the company that I've worked for all along. He was kind of like a caretaker or fencer, looking after a few farms, and just made the introduction. And then I kind of got a few lucky breaks, but I came out first I was able to get a 1 year holiday visa, once you prove you have so much money in the bank and that kind of thing. But I found out pretty quickly that there's no that whole kind of cash culture or working for cash is pretty much gone the old days. So you have to kind of go through the channels. And the first season I did was 2012, and that was it was good, but I wouldn't say it was overly enjoyable. It was tough. You're kind of green, you're new, you're starting at the bottom. Everything out here is different, and it takes a while to get your mind around just how things are done and how, I won't say backward, but I'd say definitely old-fashioned, And when you've come from such a sort of a, forward thinking technical sort of a word in Europe, and you're kind of looking at things. And even I see guys who come over from New Zealand here now, and you know, they're sort of turning their, raising their eyebrow at how things are done. But after a while, you kind of get to see that, well, you know what, it works out here, and stuff is done like that for a reason, you know.
Yeah,
like, you know, newer is not always better. Like, if something has been tried and tested and works, so yeah, there's just a bit of course, everything else is pretty much the same. Like, the, you know, I didn't have any language barriers, you know, that was all pretty straightforward. But I think it was probably after the first season I did, you know, when I just sort of maybe established myself a little bit, and into the second season then, and I started getting more of the off-road work and the bush work, and that was exactly what I had seen in the likes of those DVDs.
Yeah.
And absolutely fell in love with it, and that love's kind of hasn't really, you know, it every now and then you maybe go and do something else for a while, and you know, Europe has so much to offer as well. But
yeah,
still love getting out in the outback. I think it's the freedom of it more than anything, Matt. That would be the main thing I like about out here. And like, you work quite long hours, but when you enjoy what you do,
it's not a chore, is it?
It's not a chore, no, exactly. Yeah,
and I think what you said there about the freedom of it, that's what back in the day people used to do the European work for, was the, you know, the freedom. You ship out, and then you, unless you were phoning back, you wouldn't hear or speak to anybody, and you're pretty much on your own, weren't you? Which is what you've kind of got now to a degree yourself.
Yeah, exactly. That's it. And you know, we just get a text message from the job. It'll tell you what your next job. Like, you never know where you're going next. That's another thing I like about this job. There's so much variety. Like, you're going different places all the time. Like, so for example, now where I am down on the West Coast, you know, I was thinking the week before last, I was up in the Northern Territory, you know, so that's kind of going the other way again. And then month previous to that, I was over in Queensland, which is even further over again. So you just never, you never know. And I kind of like that. I like that sort of randomness attached to the job. I suppose the only thing is, like, it's definitely more of a single man or single person's job, because I've been counting one hand the amount of times I've been back in the yard this year, and that's since I started in early April. So it's if you're only really thinking about yourself and
so it really is a nomad style then, isn't it?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, nomad. Yeah, that's you're dead right. Yeah, it's a real nomad, but it kind of goes. It's very like I said, it's a seasonal job, so generally from about March, April, up until about November, December. So, for example, last, you know, you'll work maybe, you'll do 9 months, and then you have 3 months off. So within that 9 months, you're going hard, you know. Really have any time off, just depending on if things get a little bit quiet, a little bit busy. It just depends. Every season is so different, and I've seen that. Like, last year, it was a little bit quiet, and that was how I managed just to sneak away and came back for the Walla Truck Show and Gaydon, the retro show in Gaydon.
Yeah.
But really, you know, apart from that, like, there's no weekends. Like, I have one of those cheap Casio watches purely because I never know what day of the week it is, unless the watch. You know, it's just, yeah, there's nothing to relate it to. Like, if you're, you know, you're back in Ireland or England, you go to a town, you know, you get the feeling, you know, it's a Sunday and you see people going to mass, like, out in the bush, there's nothing. Like, it's, you just never know. So it's kind of quite nice too. You're sort of away from all that sort of Monday to Friday and the thing as well.
Yeah.
The big thing out here as well is, of course, is just it's regulation is more on the side of self-governance here than, you know, the way it is in, well, even over in the eastern states, you know, they've got, it's apart from the fact that you don't have digi cards and have logbooks, but it's a bit more that kind of totalitarian European style system, whereas in the West, Western Australia, Northern Territory, it's with no logbooks. So it's
not really,
yeah, that's, people don't, maybe some people don't kind of, you know that, because the states here have their own, the states have, maybe it's a little bit like, you know, the United States here, they have their own rules and regulations in terms of, you know, weights and just general everyday like even the signage and speed limits and that. So yeah, Western Australia and Northern Territory have managed to resist logbooks coming in. And I think it might be to do with the fact that just the distances are out here are so vast, you know. So over in Queensland and maybe where there's a thing called the NHVR, I think National Heavy Vehicle Regulator. Anyway, they're the governing body, and I think it's you're allowed to do like 12 hours or you can do 14 hours, you know, driving if you have some accreditation course, whereas over here it's 16.
Yeah. And there's no way of actually recording what you're doing. They just let you.
We have a company. I think most. I can only speak for ourselves. And I think most guys do. You record it basically yourself, and you have to have all those on record. You know, if you're audited, so it's a way of keeping kind of tracking it. But it's self governance, you know. And like if you get an audit, you need to have, you know, proven that all your drivers have handed in their timesheets and their, you know, a 7 hour break at night time. That's how it works. But you can still, you know, you can do 16 hours driving within more or less like a 17 hour spread over, and that gives you, you know, your 7 hour break. So it's quite a, you can cover a fair bit of ground in 17 hours.
Yeah, you can. Yeah,
you can. But no, it's just it goes back to, like, and I've said this before to people, you know, the system that they have in Europe with the digicars, it's just, it takes the enjoyment away. You're just governed all the time by this.
Yeah.
You know, you hit a bit of traffic somewhere and it's like, all right, well, now we're not going to make that route here as I was going to go to, or, you know, so just a little
yeah. Spot,
yeah.
It's frustrating, isn't it? Because you think, well, I'm not tired and I've got to pull up 15 minutes short and not get to where I want to be, where I know I can properly relax and my mates are there and so on and so forth. But whereas where you are, you know, in theory you could be, well, never mind, there's a bit of traffic, but I'll just carry on. And then, but the flip side, obviously, you've got to have regulations just to stop. Unfortunately, there's always going to be operators who are just going to want to push people beyond the limit. That's the most frustrating thing, isn't it?
My reading of the situation here is that the more operators out here abide by the rules and self govern themselves, they'll be left alone. That makes sense. You know, it's like rules generally are not, you know, it's not the majority. It's the few. Like with anything in life, it's the few that will kind of mess it up for the
majority.
So that's just a big. That's another, apart from, you know, the weather and, you know, the fact that I like to work and the trucks and you know, the whole, I've always been interested in the transport of livestock. I even remember when I was a young fella, you know, it was you know, drawing pictures of cattle trucks and all that. I was just fascinated at the first time I saw a double deck cattle truck, you know, and how can they even get them up there and how does it not topple over? And you know, so it's out here, it's the fact that you can even have sometimes just still stand back and look at, you know, when you have three of them together and still get that bit of a childhood kind of a fascination for it.
You're listening to the Truck and Driver podcast, brought to you by TomTom. The TomTom Go navigation offers a specific set of truck features. You can set your cargo and truck dimensions for specific routes so you can drive confidently on suitable roads, making every journey efficient and reliable. Truck yeah.
So have you always, so obviously from a young age, when you started doing your European work, were you doing cattle haulage, or was it more fridge related stuff?
No, it would have been more fridge and kind of general. So the first Continental run I ever did, that was in the year 2000. So, and that was with a Euroliner actually. I did a run up to Schiphol. It was only a couple of months old. It wasn't my truck. There was a driver on holiday, so it was like a 99 Scania, a 124-400. But it was a 124G, so for some reason it had a G chassis. That was maybe a bit of an Irish thing, you know, it set up.
I was going to say, did they seemed pretty popular for Arctics in Ireland. I just seem to remember quite a lot of them were G chassis, and I never knew why.
True. Was it the bad roads at the time? Who knows? But they had...
Possibly.
Yeah, they had that kind of, you know, a steel kind of a front bumper, you know, pretty round.
Yeah, they always looked higher than the standard for... Because my first Arctic was a 4 Series on a T-plate, so it was a 90... whatever it was. But yeah, the Gs... I don't know, the bumper looked different. They just looked like they sat a lot higher than other four series.
Yeah, correct. And I still have a couple of pictures of that, like just, you know, the first trip and that. And maybe it had an extra leaf or maybe different springs in the front, but definitely even when you set into them, you felt it. But that was, went out to Schiphol with that. And I always remember, you know, driving around, you know, these somewhere around in Schiphol, you know, out in the outskirts, and you've got all these out in the countryside and all these small drains. And I had I'd stopped at in Muir or Hazeldonk on the way up, supposed to buy like a shell.
Yeah,
there was a shell book that would get you anywhere. I'm sure you remember those. But anyway, I didn't buy that. I bought this a TNT. It was like a phone book, and I remember having that out in the steering wheel trying to find these streets. It took me a couple of hours driving around. You know, I parked up at like 2 o'clock in the morning, and they were in it. They were in at 7 and I unloaded it, whatever it was. It was some kind of stillages and you know, I was told, oh, you'll be backloading in Holland. And next thing, you know, you get a message like, so it was in Germany, somewhere over by, I think, or somewhere like that. Jesus, I had to drive to, I remember getting to the motorway and I didn't even have a map or anything, and they had no map for sale there. So I needed to get a map, but I just asked the woman at the cash register, which way is Germany? You know, she looked at me and pointed. But anyway, yeah, I had to go and backload countertops, and of course somehow managed to find it. Like, I didn't even know the difference between junction numbers and road numbers, you know, looking down this map, and probably drove through a few towns and finally got there. They wouldn't load me and because I had no straps, and I had to go and buy straps. And anyway, yeah, it was just, you know, your first trip, everyone remembers their first trip. And I came home, I don't even know what way I came to Belgium, and you know, it's nearly too nervous to get much sleep, and came back to Fishguard. I think it was coming back through England, and I rang them or texted them to say I was up for both, and they were like, oh, well, we didn't think you'd be there till tomorrow, you know. So obviously didn't. So nervous. Yeah, so nervous. Anyway, got that one over me. And then after that, Matt, it was a mixture then of kind of Euroliner work and fridge work. And it was great because, you know, you got to see so many different countries. Like, there's countries that you will get to see if you're doing international livestock transport, and then there's other countries that you won't. For example, like, you'll never really get up around Scandinavia and that. So that was another chat we had lately, just myself and a friend of mine. We were on about the really a lot of the long distance kind of exotic destination work now is more or less pharmaceutical work. I don't know if you've
noticed, yes,
like pharma now is such a big thing. But yeah, that was brilliant. Like, I did that for probably about 2.5-3 years, you know, and got this, you know, take off a lot of countries. Did a lot of Spain and Italy, which were my favorite. Like, started off doing Germany, which wasn't, you know, it was all right, but it was more the kind of the Mediterranean countries I wanted to do, and got,
yeah,
Norway and Sweden, Finland. Really, really loved it up there. That was probably the most
memorable.
Oh yeah, just absolutely fantastic. Love it, and still do love it up there. So then, you know, after did that for a few years, and then decided I'd jump on the livestock. So again, never forget the first trip with livestock, and, you know, in absolutely no training whatsoever. Just like, yeah, met the truck in Dublin. It was on offloading onions in the market, and I was sent up to the west of Ireland to load cattle, and just with the instructions, you know, like, don't tell them you haven't done cattle before. And they're like, oh, will you not know, you know? I was like, no, just you'd be grand, like, so. Yeah, I mean, it was a Houghton. I don't know if you know the Houghton cattle trailers.
Yeah, are they something to do with Park House?
Yeah, Houghton Park.
Yeah, Houghton Park House. Yeah,
still going. So now they don't use those for the international, you know, end of things down there.
Too high, are they?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, because they didn't have the same at the time. They didn't have that same style of lift and floor. So what you had was you had the top deck. Like, it wouldn't come all the way down to the floor, you know, and be lifted up. You could lift it up kind of out of it. But anyway, yeah, it was about, I think they were about 4.2, and I remember guys having trouble getting through the Frasers Tunnel. They'd pull up and let down the airbags to go in. But anyway, I remember going to Spain with the Houghton, and you know, we'd backload onions in them. Of course, you had that step, you know, so it was kind of quite hard to get the onions up on the neck, and had two little ramps for rolling the pallet truck up there to get the onions. But yeah, that first night, like leaving Roscommon and you know, coming down, it's pretty kind of narrow, twisty roads, and just that feeling of how it sways around. I was definitely taking it easy, but yeah, it's like anything, you get in and sink or swim, and there's always a great kind of camaraderie. And, you know, you get down to the ferry, and, you know, you meet lads, and they'll put you right and follow a few lads down the road, and yeah, it was so that was mainly, you know, the livestock end of things was was primarily Spain and Italy, did a lot of Italy, so kind of north of Italy there. And then the more exotic ones would have been Morocco. We took cattle down to Morocco. That was go down past Agadir, turn left for Taradant in there, did a few loads down there, and then Russia back nearly 20 years ago now, took pigs out to Russia for Edward Gilder. So that was a really, really interesting trip as well, and probably never have got to do that unless I was doing doing livestock. So I know you probably you see places like that with the stage with the concert transport, would you?
Yeah, oh, definitely. Yeah, and Russia was one of my favourites to head to, just because it was just so different. As soon as you got across the border, you could just tell you were just somewhere completely sort of alien as to what you sort of knew. And
would you say Russia was the most different country? Like, you got that feeling of, you know, I really am somewhere different. And also, did you go in through Belarus as well?
We didn't used to. If we're doing a show in Belarus, we'd go in, just because it's one or two extra borders that you didn't want to faff about with. So we would always normally go through Latvia, or if we're coming from Scandinavia, going through Finland at Valimar, which was the best border because the Finns would stamp you out, wave you off and say good luck, and then you just start queuing for Russia, whereas the Latvian border, they're pretty good at holding you up as well as the Russians. So I did do Belarus a couple of times. But yeah, just only if we're doing gigs, you'd never transit there. Just save time. Even though the Belarus-Russian border is just a border post now and nothing else.
Oh, is that right? Okay, because back then, we had to get... So the big thing, of course, was getting the visa, you know, to go into Russia, send your passport away, and that took a bit of time. And you had to do the same for... But I do have pictures like of going across the border of Belarus. We had to get, you know, go through the passport and that. So you said that's not there now, is it?
No, from what I'm told, because I've been there for quite some time, it's just like a post that's occasionally manned, and that's it. I think they might have occasional passport control and whatnot. I mean, obviously, since the war has kicked off, God knows what it's like. It must be very different. And again, going back to what you said about the farmer stuff, that would be one of the only things really going in. I know a Facebook friend of mine, Paulie, who works for an Italian company, he quite often goes there. But I remember as well on my first ever trip, or second, one of the others, I actually saw one of Pullin's on the way to Moscow, or he was. We were on our way out, which sort of surprised me really to actually see another Brit over there, which was quite nice. But I guess most people used to just transit Belarus into Smolensk and go that way, just because it was a much quicker way in theory than going around.
Yeah, with that time we were going across Germany and Poland. Terespol was the border, Belarus. But yeah, there was long. Yeah. I think there was pretty big queues that time. But because we had livestock, we were able to go around, and but still a lot of, you know, faffing around with documentation, and you know, you're going through that no man's land then in between the two countries. And you know, I remember it being pretty weary, like you could have just maybe spent the whole night, you know, going from doing customs, and then it's just getting bright, and you know, you're into a day's work then. But it was all part of it, I suppose, for those blokes who were doing the continent or doing long distance driving. That was just kind of part of how it was, and you had to kind of keep up in the queue, or you lost your place. So we were kind of reasonably lucky in that regard, just that we were given a bit of priority. But just what you said about Russia, I do remember that, even like going from Poland to Belarus. Belarus is pretty barren, not really much kind of going on there. But then when you went further east and you went into Russia, the minute you went over the border, like, I felt so different again. A bit more activity, you know, you had people, especially women, out on the side of the road selling stuff, whatever they were selling, you know, bread or eggs and that. You know, it definitely, it sort of makes me think, you know, what would it be like now? Because when you get out into the countryside in Russia, you know, that probably, you know, wouldn't have been really that long after kind of communism, you know, and there was still that sort of an air, you know, that general feeling of that sort of, that old kind of collectivism, communist culture. I'm sure the cities are out of this world in terms of, you know, wealth if you go into certain areas. But I would like to just often wonder what would Russia be like now in the countryside. But just ask you, when you said you had a friend from Italy doing farming, he's hardly driving for Chigiato, is he?
He used to, but he's now working for Rebony.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Doing it. So I don't know whether he's took the work with him or, but yeah, Gigliotti. They bought a Wagon and Drag, didn't they, to specialise going to Iran, which I guess they're still running. Don't know if you ever saw that or not.
The FA16 750.
I think it was a Scania. I thought it was a Scania, the Wagon and Drag, but I could be wrong.
A friend actually sent me a picture recent times, only last few months, of Chigiato. I'm pretty sure it was a black. I'm not sure. Anyway, it was Origin Drag, close couple, definitely 750. That was in Cherbourg. He was on the way to Ireland, so they were quite a bit in and out of Ireland and have for farm and that. Like, all the gear is top spec. But I have seen them in Russia before. Actually, that might have been your friend. Was he driving a Volvo at that time? He was going to Russia.
The Pullins was a Mercedes at the time, because I actually managed to get a photo of it going along. I remember, but yeah, I mean, even like, I know, I don't know whether Hannon's have always done Farmer, but they've certainly got a Farmer division, or it's advertised on their trucks now. And Caffrey's, they certainly do it, don't they? And them boys tend to get around a fair bit distance wise, don't they?
Yeah, well, it's quite a big thing in Ireland, and it's been responsible for the growth of a lot of hauliers in Ireland. Like Dixon would have been a big player in the getting in early in that Farmer end of things, and they're pretty much all barrier kind of traditional meat hauliers, which would have been that real, the ones you would have remembered back from the 80s and 90s. The Farmer only sort of came in, I presume, and sort of became a thing in the maybe late 90s, sort of 2000s. But you'd see them all, like all DG, McCardle, I'm sure, Noon, they're all Jones, it's all very much Farmer based. And like you said, Caffrey, that was where I actually, when I got to go up around Scandinavia and that was Farmer in the early days. But just interesting, you said Rebony. I do remember seeing Rebony being in North Africa before, going a fair way
down. Yeah,
so possibly Farmer as well.
Yeah, it's just still seems crazy what goes overland and where things like that. And going back to Russia, I've started writing a piece for the magazine, which hopefully will be of interest, but it's just talking about some of the companies sort of post-war, because just before Putin invaded, I don't know if you were abroad as much, if you were in Oz or not, but if you were in Europe, the amount of Russian trucks was just getting staggering. It really was. And several of the big companies from like Lithuania, Latvia, they had opened up places in Russia, flagging out. And obviously, overnight, pretty much, that all stopped. But there's means and ways around it, and that's why a lot of the big Russian hauliers now have got trucks registered in Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan, just to get around the sanctions. And so one of them in particular is offering, they do a overland service from China. Now the Chinese borders opened up, they'll load within Chinese provinces and deliver door-to-door, I think, in 14 days from China to Berlin. And the others are doing like regular service from Pakistan and Afghanistan, sort of up towards, into Russia and then overland across and whatnot. So there's some pretty fascinating sort of big trips still being had, just not really by us.
Yeah. Well, that's the broader issue, isn't it, really, with European transport, and we could get very, very misty-eyed about, going back. I think we just probably caught the tail end of when it was, trucks were doing the work, international work, from all over Europe. But every now and then I'd sort of fantasize about being sort of, teleported back to the 90s when you'd see, Norwegian trucks down in places down the Mediterranean and that. But look, it's changed, changed quite a lot now. And it's interesting what you say about the registrations. And one thing I noticed when I was back home for a couple of years, especially down in France, and I did seem to notice more Moroccans. I didn't really have seen as much before that. I know you've always had the Turks, but I've noticed Moroccans, and it is. I still have that bit of a fascination. When you see a strange registration plate, and you think how far some fella has driven, but unfortunately, most of the bulk of what you see now when you're out in the continent is like, LT and PL reg.
LV, yeah, PL, EST, yeah. And it's what really frustrates me about the situation is people blaming the drivers, and it's not the driver's fault. They're just trying to earn a living. Simple as that. And it's the hauliers and the system is the problem, not the drivers. You know, they're just trying to put food on the table at the end of the day.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then you know, if you see a lot of times, you know, you see a truck with a particular registration plate, it's not guaranteed that the driver is actually from that country, you know.
Definitely not.
Might have a lot of Ukrainians driving like Lithuanian trucks and that, but look.
Yes.
Some are good, some are probably not so good, like definitely the overall standard.
Yeah.
Look, it's just like driving across the board, really, a standard is, you know, I was just thinking back earlier when I was thinking about, you know, what we were going to talk about, and just, you know, one of the hauliers I would have driven for early in my career, you know, had a, it wouldn't have been that easy to get a job there back, you know, before my time, like 80s, 90s, like you had to, you sort of had to really be, you know,
maybe know someone there.
Know someone there, yeah, exactly. And
yeah.
I think there was someone, I don't know whether it was right or not, someone passed the comment that, like, he wouldn't have drivers from, even from a certain county, like from the big, you know, he could be selective, you know, there would be a bit of kind of county rivalry there. So just how much things have changed and continue to change. You know, we've had the big influx of Eastern Europeans, and now I see it's, you know, we've got Indians coming into a lot of places as well, and
yeah,
Filipinos and that. So yeah, it's definitely a big change, but it's good that you're still documenting and writing about the golden days of it, I presume, are you?
Yeah, certainly trying to, anyway, whilst people are sort of willing to talk about it. And it's just, me and Ashley Cogger have talked about this before several times, you know, there still must be out there, God knows how many hundreds of old photos from, like, the, you know, glory days, in inverted commas, just sat in people's drawers, because people don't think there's any interest in them, you know, or, you know, members of the family have maybe passed away or whatever, and they've taken some photos, and they're not the best, but, you know, there's a bit of a grainy shot of a truck somewhere that looks strange. You know, how many more are there out there? Because stashes still keep popping up, and if you've got the stories and the knowledge to go with them photos, it really brings them to life. And again, that's what one thing, like social media, people who just take people's photos and then repost them, you know, just to get a few likes, you've lost all that knowledge of that photo, of what it's about and why it was taken and where. And it's just, that's what really, really bugs me as well. But, you know, that's another time.
I think that some people that, I don't think they kind of realise what they're doing. I don't think, you know, they mean much harm. They don't see much of an issue in it, you know, whereas if you see a photo you've taken being posted by someone, like, it's, you wouldn't be too happy, put it like that. It's just something, it's like it's a moment in time that you've you know, taken the time to record and get developed and send it, and then it's just been kind of hoard around. So I think most photographers will get that, and every now and then, like, if someone wants to use a photo, or, you know, if you want to use someone's photo, like, all I have to do is just ask you, oh yeah, go ahead. Like, it's not like they're,
yeah, that's all they've got to do, just ask permission. And
I'll give you an example. Sorry, there was those Russian trips we did back in, you know, around 2006, that time a friend of mine brought a video camera along with him, and he did turned out to be quite a good video of it, and just burned it onto a few DVDs and handed it around.
Now, I've actually got a copy of that.
Well, you have one copy more. I don't even have a copy of that, and every now and then I have people asking me for it, and I don't even have it, and the guy who actually made it, he never intended it to get distributed the way it was anyway. And I think the problem is now at the moment, I've asked him a few times and I don't even ask him anymore. I think it's to get it from DVD onto you know, digital. There's some issue there, but the point was, it went, there you go, you've seen it, so that's the point. But it turned up on eBay then. Yeah, he was not too impressed, but the bloke that he was sending, like, didn't understand it. Like, He was more or less saying, oh, wow, it's an amazing kind of trip you've done, and I just want to see people to see it. And he's like, listen, you didn't make the video, and I never intended it to be distributed like that. I think he didn't understand why it was an issue. So I think people don't do it. Well, he was making money off it, so he should have understood.
Yeah. Yeah, that's why he's done it. Simple as that, isn't it? You know, it's a financial incentive to do it.
Yeah, yeah. But anyway, I suppose it kind of to go around full circle. You know, it was magazines really. That's what, and reading about things that would have given me the wanderlust, and that was, you know, pre YouTube when I was growing up, and that's, you know, probably how we know each other is through the Truck and Driver magazine and writing.
Yeah.
And just I was going to say that I have one coming out next month on the Bamako Rally. Have you heard about that rally?
No, I haven't.
So, well, I hadn't either until a guy who had done an article about in the magazine before. He had an F8 16660. I did a double header, I should say. There was a 660 tag axle and there was a 600 4x2. Anyway, I did it as a double header, kind of rare sort of 16-litre Volvos in Ireland. But anyway, he went on the Bamako Rally with, I think, six other fellas, and they did it in an old fire engine. So a Renault G230, you know, with that 94 shape with the
club. Oh yeah, the square cab.
Yeah, the square cab. Yeah, and I was just thinking this actually. Can you know what were the four manufacturers involved in the Club of Four? Was it
the Club of Four? So there was Volvo.
Yeah.
DAF. Renault.
Yeah.
And Iveco, Magirus Deutz.
Congratulations, you are an anorak.
I know. Yes.
I wouldn't have got all of them. I would have been stumbling and starting. But anyway, they bought this and they took it on the rally. So it's like basically a poor man's Paris Dakar, more or less.
Right. Okay.
A lot more cost effective than the
yeah.
But it begins in Budapest and it used to end in Bamako, which is in Mali. But through political turbulence and that, it now ends in Sierra Leone. Freetown. So it was quite good. It's a lot of Hungarians on it, and it's a lot of four wheel drives. But they were the only ones doing it in a fire truck, so it was quite interesting. So I have that coming out in the next magazine, and
excellent.
Yeah, just something a bit different. I'm just getting a little bit low.
Yeah.
On stock of articles now, so just it'll be something a bit different. But yeah, the long distance trips. I think that's what. Yeah, I remember reading about, you know, Centrum from Holland going to Romania before, and stuff like that. Just seeing pictures of horses and carts, and I think that just really gave the wanderlust.
Oh, definitely. And I recently inherited a whole load of old magazines just to go through, and unfortunately, I don't really have the space to keep everything. So I was having to be quite ruthless, but just sitting, flicking back through them and looking at some of the stuff, it was just wonderful. And like some of the aid runs that people used to do to Romania from Britain. You know, taking clothes out and whatnot. And in fact, a good friend of mine, Bernie Martin, he used to go, I think, every year for Brynors out of Felixstowe. They used to do a charity run, which I think was covered at one point. And just things like the Challenge Annika aid run to Romania that they did and never made the air, which is such a shame, you know, because it's so involved. And just all the old adverts and things like that. It's just again, a snapshot in time. And at the time, you just don't think it's going to change. And it's the same with our work. You know, when you're doing it and involving it, it's just going to kind of go on forever. But then all of a sudden, it just stops and things change. And it's if people aren't recording at the time what's going on, you just lose it all, don't you? And it's very easy to do.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and the long distance diaries. I remember, like, you know, in Truck Magazine was a standalone publication. They had long distance diaries with a little bit of art in the middle and picture of a gendarme, you know, waving his finger, or, you know, French man with onions around his neck.
Yeah, not stereotypical at all.
Not at all. No. Horse and carts in Russia, and it was. That was great, but hopefully we can continue to kind of keep it going as much as we can.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've started to do a few, I think I've mentioned before on the podcast, I'm trying to track down some of the old show trucks and sort of what happened to them and the original owners. It was an idea that got suggested to me, and I just love the idea, and it's fascinating. And I believe the next issue is my first one, which is on Craig Potter's trucks, if you remember him.
Sure do. The Ice Warrior 2,
yeah. And then he had the Road Warrior, and yeah, the Ice Warrior 2, which was his sister's, I believe.
I was getting excited now. I think we're going to have to do a separate podcast just about show trucks, because that was I had all those quotes. So that 143 with it had Riggs and Twigs written up on the cabin.
That's right.
CB shop somewhere, wasn't it?
Yes, it was Town Bristol Way, I think, because they also had, I don't know who actually owned it, they had an 88, didn't they, with like a Swedish drum box sleeper on the back as well, which was that a tag axle? That was quite a machine, and that had rigs and twigs all over it as well.
Ringing a faint bell in the back of my mind.
Yeah, I'll have to dig a photo out of that. Yeah, that would be an interesting one to try and find out about, because from what Craig told me, the Ice Warrior, the Scania, that was the first full airbrush job that Matt, the painter, ever did. So, yeah, it was never meant to be like that. It was just going to do, I think, the side deflectors and a couple of bits and pieces. And I think he was, I can't remember without looking at my notes, but he was either in college or just sort of finished, you know, his sort of apprenticeship. And so he sort of badgered Craig, I think, to fully airbrush the thing. He's like, yeah, all right then. And that was the outcome of it.
And he was, and probably still is, from what I gathered, like the big name in airbrushing. And am I right?
I would say so.
That truck was turned over. It was rolled, wasn't it? I remember seeing a picture, and I don't
know
how to recover from that.
Yeah. Craig had sold it. It got rolled, so it got a new cab, but it was just painted white. And then after that, I'm not too sure what happened to it.
So there was a centre page picture of that 143. It was a tracking shot. I don't know who took it. I think it was pulling a C-lane curtain cider behind it.
All right.
I think so, yeah. I just remember that. It was deadly anyway, yeah. And then, of course, the...
Because
he had two Super Space cabs. He had a
yes.
Left hook, yeah. 430 as well.
That's right, yeah. And I can't remember what happened to the Cummins one, but his sister's one, Kerry's one, when that got sold, it got bought by the removal company, UTS, and just got painted white. So just think, why on earth would you buy a truck like that with the advertising potential for your business and then just paint it white? Mad, and absolutely mad. So, perhaps we'll have to do a separate podcast on old show trucks. That'd be pretty good. Get some more ideas going.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, because I've got quite a few sort of on my list to try and track down. And incidentally as well, whilst we're on the subject, I talked about this before, and somebody got in touch with Dougie about getting in contact with Graham Cordner, because I know a fair bit about his old truck and where it is and where it's been. And apparently Graham now is a director for a tyre company in Peterhead, but whoever it was who got in contact, if they can get in contact with Graham, I'd greatly appreciate it, because I've tried and I've failed so far to actually get any headway over speaking to Graham himself, and I'd dearly love to, if possible.
Well, I'm sure you would have seen the, I think it was on the Discovery Channel, I ended up putting it on DVD, but Outlaws, that Graham was on.
Yes. I was talking about this programme just the other day, funnily enough, because there was Graham, the late Kay Phillips, Chris Harriott, this is the one you're talking about, isn't it? Chris Harriott and his mate from...
Driving for...
he was known as a driver for Keebles.
Yeah.
And his mate Nigel had a 3 Series Streamline Wagon and Dragged. And
yeah, some crowd from Somerset, was it? What's that?
RT Keeble.
Keeble, yes. Yeah, I watched it so many times. And Graham Cordner seemed like such a legend even then. You know, his house in Peterhead.
Yeah.
And showing off the trophies and that. And yeah, he was just...
With a bowling alley.
Oh, yeah. And I remember he was just like, you know, sitting in the truck driving down the road, and he's probably not really that smooth of a ride in a... In a tag axle Scania, like,
no,
with his shirt on. He's like, "Ah, yeah, well, all of my mates are after giving it up. I'm the only one left." And I thought, I want to be him. So,
because I remembered about that program, and nobody I spoke to seemed to remember it. And then I can't remember, another friend of mine, a message, and he came back straight away with the name of it. So I was straight on a YouTube, found it, and just sat there and watched it. So I was like, oh my God, I'm 20 years younger or more watching this again. Oh, it's fantastic.
Yeah, Chris Harriott and his mate. Yeah, they remember they pulled into Les Mahago, and the guy, the Scottish guy's, you know, slagging him off over spending all that money on the truck and you know, I don't have the money in my pocket, you know.
Yeah.
All the stereotypes. So good. So anyway, on that note, I better go and do. I'm just about.
Go do a bit.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to have to unhook. So we're with the strong wind here, and We're burning through fuel at a fairly tremendous rate at the moment. So I've got, you know, the truck holds about roughly about 2,000 litres, and then I've got a 700 litre belly tank on the lead trailer. And then as a back,
yep.
I've got another 750 litre tank on the second trailer. But in order to get to that, I have to unhook just the prime mover tractor unit, as we call it, and just reverse down the side, plug in an airline and just get that fuel. So that's what I'm going to do next. And head up the road again.
Right,
it was good to catch up anyway, and we'll have a few ideas for next.
Most enjoyable, Paul. Yeah, we should definitely do one on show trucks, without a doubt.
Definitely, yeah. Show trucks, that'd be an idea, and I think maybe 16-litre Volvos then is another one. I think you're doing a
bit yes.
on a knife at a sort of a, you know, one of my likes as well. So, interest. So, yeah, that'll be good for next time, Matt.
Yeah, definitely, mate. Well, you truck on steady down there.
Yeah, and you have a good trip. I think you believe you're heading for Greece tomorrow, are you?
Yes, mate. Yep, off to Greece tomorrow with the dogs. And then, yeah, tip Rafina Port and reload Bologna on the way back. I think that's the plan. So, nice little round trip.
Lovely. Well, enjoy, and we'll catch
you. Perfect. All right, mate. All the best, Paul. Speak to you soon.
Thank you. Bye out.
Thank you for tuning in to the Truck and Driver podcast, proudly sponsored by TomTom. As a special thanks to our listeners for trucking through the holiday season, we're giving away 1 month free of TomTom Go Navigation Truck. Simply download the Go Navigation app and use the code TRUCKYEAH. That's TRUCKYEAH when subscribing. Safe travels, folks.